This is an ABC podcast.
Kia ora na and good fella morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Pacific Beat, it comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Hope you're having a great morning. This morning we have the latest update on the earthquake in East Sepik in PNG. Are we ready for cover to be grown outside of the Pacific? And how a racial slur landed one Pacifica NRL player on an 8-week suspension. We'll have more on those stories shortly. And remember, once our show is done, our stories will go up online for you to replay. You can also share these across your social media platforms. Simply type Pacific Beat Radio Australia into your search engine. And remember, you can visit our ABC Pacific page on Facebook and Instagram, and we welcome your feedback. Let's get into the show. I'm Aggie Dubon. This is Pacific Beat. We start in Papua New Guinea, where more than 1,000 homes have been destroyed after a magnitude 7 earthquake struck the Sepik region of PNG. The death toll stands at 3, but authorities fear it could rise higher as information from remote and isolated communities come to hand. As Belinda Cora in PNG reports, the earthquake hasn't been the only disaster to strike the area in recent weeks.
For weeks, there had been heavy rains and flooding along the Sepik River, but on Sunday, disaster struck when a magnitude 7.0 earthquake hit the area.
And all of a sudden, there was a earthquake yesterday, 7.0 magnitude. It's a big one. Then last time we experienced was the one at East Chambri Lake was 6.0, but today it was 7.0 was a big one, but many houses have been fallen, while some was washed out by the flood.
Gideon Malo is a community volunteer helping affected families in Wasarogawe district and collecting vital information for a government assessment report. He's worried that many families are still struggling to move to higher grounds at this time.
Help themselves looking for ways to a safer place to allocate their property or move from the high flood area to the safest side, which is the land is high. So then they can be safe. But at this moment, it's a double disaster for them. So people are looking for help, trying to get some sort of assistance to evacuate them to the higher ground.
East Sepik Governor Alan Bird says more than 1,000 homes have been destroyed along with food gardens. Cyril Tara, a community leader from Kamanibit village, is worried food will soon run out.
So what I ask for the authorities from the province, all districts, to come down and have a check on the situation. And also we have no food, no rations. Water, it's very important, so immediately we need all this.
The Papua New Guinea government has announced 500 million kina in funding for natural disaster relief, which will also assist those affected in East Sepik. But in Wasarogawe district, Gideon Malo is worried government funds won't make it to the people most in need.
That's all I want from the government to do. I don't like people to use the disaster as their grounds to get things and then they don't look at those that have been affected. So these are some of the things that has been happened for the last earthquake. April around. So this time I want those things to reach those affected people all the way from down Sepik and all the way up Sepik too.
And that's Gideon Malo from Wasarogawe District. The reporter there was Belinda Cora with that story. Well, for more on the latest on the earthquake and flooding in the Sepik region, we're joined this morning by East Sepik Governor Alan Bird. With that, I say good morning, Governor.
Good morning.
Yeah, thank you very much, Governor, for joining us this morning. Firstly, I know over the weekend you surveyed the damage by air. What was really your reaction when you saw the damage?
Well, it was quite severe, obviously. I think we've had similar severe flooding, certainly in my memory, I think in 1996 and in 1983. So this severe flooding, the previous cycle occurred about 15, 20 years apart. And so we're kind of like due for it. And it's happened again. But this time, obviously, we've got more people living in the impacted areas. And so we know that the impact is going to be much more, severe, because we've got to move food and things like that. And but I think we're a lot better prepared this time around, because unlike in the past where we've had to depend on the national government, this time we've actually got the funds, we've got enough money at home to do these things.
Governor, we've obviously heard that there have been 3 deaths, about 1,000 homes destroyed. What do you know so far in terms of the extent of the damage? Again, has there been any updates on these stats?
Okay, we've got 5 deaths, so that's the unfortunate situation. I guess in hindsight, we only had 2 deaths as a result of flooding. One of them is a landslide, but that wasn't on the CP Green. That was in the WeWork area. So with the houses collapsing, that's when we had another 3 deaths, because obviously the homes on the river, the foundations have become weakened as a result of the flooding. So when the houses collapsed, with people still inside them, they were trapped under the water. And so they died as a result of drowning, because the earthquake came at 6 in the morning. So those who were still asleep, that was what made it difficult for them to get out. So we've had 5 deaths. We haven't been able to compile an accurate report yet, even though we've probably got about 80% of it done. This time we've tried to do it differently, to get the ward members from the villages to send the reports through to a central location using mobile phones. So rather than us going out and doing a survey, which could take weeks, we're using the mobile network to get reports in so that we can formulate a response plan to the impacted areas quicker, as opposed to us doing the survey ourselves, given the large area involved and the difficulty of transport to sort of get to the places where the people are most affected.
Yeah, look, we just want to give our thoughts and prayers to those who have obviously lost a loved one. Governor, as you look at priorities, especially for the emergency workers there, what would be the top of the list?
Well, we've declared an emergency as of yesterday. And so our priority, number one, is obviously the medical responses to those who were injured as a result of the earthquake. So that already began on Sunday. So we've managed to evacuate those that needed the most help. We've got 2 float planes in the province. They've been operating there for a while, so they were able to land, given the high water, in the affected areas and pick up injured people and shift them to the main hospital in WeWork. That's been done, so care is ongoing. Our second concern is obviously going to be the move empty plastic containers into the area, into the areas affected, so that people can be able to store water, because it's still raining, and if we can get clean drinking water, then we can store it. The other thing we're trying to do is a water filter program, which has been very effective in the lower Sepik. And we've been trying to go across the length of the Sepik. So using these filters, which are quite light, the easier to move around, and every family can own one, and they can filter up to, because there's water all around them. So if we can clean that up, and these filters come from the US, we've had a program going for about 2 years, but unfortunately we've only covered the lower Sepik so far, and we're just going to have to ramp them up and try to get more water filters in. Because once the water recedes, we're going to get, which is going to take about 4 to 6 weeks, drinking water is going to become more and more of a problem. And obviously, we can't keep shifting clean water into the areas, because that's going to become more unsustainable. So I'm going to be meeting with the U.S. government this week and those filters, and hopefully we can get some help in by way of, say, maybe a military aircraft flying them across to us from the US. And once we have the filters, we can quickly deploy teams in most affected areas, which is actually the entire river system, 800 kilometers long, and then try to get these filters and buckets to all the affected families, so we can try to minimize the impact of the waterborne diseases that we expect are going to come in the next 4 weeks. And then, of course, there's food. We organized this on Friday for local food production, particularly sago in the areas that are not affected by flooding. We've got about maybe, I'd say, 20% of our population affected by the flooding. So the others are not affected. So they've already started producing more food. We've got a lot of sago and other food crops. So we've got every single local level government mobilized to try to get food ready and shifted to these areas where the people are affected. So that's happening now. By declaring an emergency, we can actually start drawing down government funds that we already have. We're not going to wait for the national government. The concerns by our people are correct. I mean, national government is always slow. This time around, we've been pretty frugal and with our funding and over the years. And so we've got a considerable savings that we can access. But given the very cumbersome procurement requirements of the country, we've had to declare a national emergency. So it'll be up to the administration to make sure that the funds are spent correctly and they get to the affected people. And as I said, this time around, we're trying to use the entire system of government. So basically, all public servants are going to be involved and all elected officials are going to be involved in distributing the help. We also need canvases, because obviously with the rain and the collapsed houses, we need, you know, people need tarpaulins to just keep themselves dry and their belongings dry, and of course firewood dry, you know, kindling, so they can have fuel to cook and do other things. Once the water recedes and the houses collapsing, they didn't just collapse on the river, they collapsed all over the province. So we've got to help people getting a basic building kit so they can start rebuilding as soon as the situation allows. And of course, kitchen kits, cooking utensils, pots, cutlery, plates and cups, things like that, which they would have lost during the incidents that happened, you know, with the houses collapsing and things like that.
Governor, we wish you well, and we know that there is a lot to do in terms of recovery. But again, our thoughts and prayers are with you and the East Sepik region. We thank you for your time this morning.
Appreciate your call, and thank you to your listeners.
That, of course, is Alan Bird, Governor of East Sepik Province, here on Pacific Beat.
Here at ABC Radio Australia, we've tripled our Pacific-focused content, which means we're sounding more and more Pacific every day. Tune in across the week to hear a fresh, new lineup of Pacific voices and shows on your favourite subjects like sport, music and culture. Go online to abc.net.au/Pacific to find out more. ABC Radio Australia, yours in the Pacific.
Now, a group of American guava growers has produced its first locally grown crop with hopes of serving the lucrative US market on an industrial scale. But some of the Pacific are not happy, fearing the move will undercut their own product. And they've accused the Americans of appropriating the culturally important crop. Carl Evans with more.
American grown guava. It's a phrase you've probably never heard before. But over in the United States, a trio of kava entrepreneurs want to change that after growing their own unique mix of kava straight from American soil.
This started, you know, back in 2014 with the mission to see how far we can push kava as a plant. Is it only able to grow in the Pacific Islands? Can it grow other places? There's a lot of kava drinkers here in the U.S. It's 2024. We've got about 10 million kava drinkers. So that was kind of where it started. Let's see if we can actually grow this plant on mainland. And what we found was that kava is willing to adapt.
Tyler Blythe is a kava bar owner and distributor based in California. 3 years ago, he teamed up with Jeffrey Bowman and Matt Musifillo to create American Kava Culture, a group aimed at producing kava for the American market. Here's Jeffrey Bowman.
I've been importing and selling kava, distributing kava, and running a kava bar since 2002 every day of my life. Tyler and Matt and I all compete in the kava industry, but we're all friends. Tyler basically brought Matt and I on board when he got to a point with his kava growing research that he needed to try to see if the kava would grow here in Florida. He lives in California.
Turns out it does. The trio have produced batches of kava at both ends of the country using cultivars from Hawaii. They'll use it to supply their own bars first, with hopes of eventually expanding it to the 400 others across the US. For Matt, who is of Pacific American descent, the venture allows him to bring his culture full circle.
Whenever the people of the Pacific voyage to a new island or a new village or a new land, they always brought their agriculture with them. It's only in the last 100 years where there's been this disconnect where the people have stopped bringing their agriculture to grow. So we're really just coming full circle now with bringing kava to the people, because in America, there's more Tongans in America than there are in Tonga.
But not all growers are thrilled. Jonathan Naupa manages a kava business in Vanuatu. He grows and exports 24 tons of kava a year and is trying to crack the US market.
I just find it alarming from a local perspective. The vast majority of our farmers in Vanuatu are small lot subsistence farmers. You know, they grow kava to supply their communities for community ceremonies. They use it as a cash crop to pay for their children's education, their medical bills, their building materials when a cyclone comes along, you know, which is friggin' too often. And the kava plantings, they act as a tree bank or a shrub bank. You know, they're like they're sort of a family savings account for a rainy day. And the United States is like our major export market, you know. So any production in the United States, on the continental United States, you know, with the goal of capturing a share of the US market, it's going to like just going to smash us here, mate. If I were them, I'd be concentrating on setting up traceable pathways from Vanuatu to the end market in the United States and making that a beautiful story and everyone cutting the cake fairly. But no, they want the whole cake to themselves.
Pacific academics have taken issue as well, saying the US operation lays claim to an aspect of Pacific culture that isn't rightly theirs. Here's Sione Funaki, a doctoral student and anthropologist at the University of Hawaii.
Kava to us is not just a plant. It is an ancestor. It is an ancestral crop. We see ourselves being genealogically connected to this plant, right? Hawaiians cite it in their 2,000-line genealogical chant called the Kumulipo. Tongans claim genealogical claims to it as well, that it comes from a young girl and her family. It is a representation of the land, the people, our culture, our ancestors, and our descendants. When you take something as special and as important as that out of our realm, out of our areas, you know, you challenge our right and our indigenous right to continue to use that. You threaten the livelihoods of farmers, but also cultural practitioners now who depend on kava as a part of our daily rituals and routines. So I think that's kind of the main problem with it. By growing it outside of the Pacific, threatens the very foundations of our culture.
Fears have also been raised by scientist and kava expert Dr. Vincent Lebeau, who told the Fiji Times the variety of cultivar being promoted by the Americans, a variety known as Issa, was potentially dangerous and could threaten kava's reputation. But the Americans aren't concerned. They say the Issa variety is just one of many cultivars they own and has been diligently researched and lab tested to ensure consumer safety.
We're talking several thousand lab tests on different kava cultivars. And so, you know, there's ways of growing Issa. And when you take a cultivar from, say, Papua New Guinea, where it's very hot and the climate is different and the soil is different, and you plant it in a new environment, you see changes. The outputting product is much different than, perhaps what Lebeau or some other scientists think of as Issa, because they've never grown it anywhere else.
Despite opposition from some, the group believes that as their operation grows, so too will the profile of kava. And all growers, including those based in the Pacific, will benefit.
We have 400 kava bars here in the U.S. We want 4,000 and then we want 40,000. We want to continue to promote kava. So everything that we're doing with American kava simply promotes kava. We're growing the pie. We're going to grow the pie 10 times larger than what it is. And the Pacific is going to benefit 90% of that growth, and we're going to take our 10%.
As for cultural appropriation, well, the group acknowledges the argument against them. However, they point out that Polynesians in the US outnumber those in the Pacific, and almost all kava drinking habits are casual, not ceremonial.
By definition, cultural appropriation only takes place when the people who are appropriating the culture do not acknowledge or recognize the culture and where it's taken from. And I can tell you with 100% certainty that everyone knows that kava comes from the South Pacific. And, you know, you come into an American kava bar, you come into my kava bar, you will find decorations there from the Fiji Islands, from Vanuatu, from the Solomon Islands, from Papua New Guinea, from Vanuatu. You know, it's impossible to say that we're appropriating a culture when we're making sure that everyone knows, hey, this is where we got this idea. You know, it's kind of a silly argument to me.
And that was Jeffrey Bowman of American Gava Culture, ending that report by Kyle Evans. And we have heard about what kava producers are doing there in the US, but this week Pacific kava growers and experts are meeting in Fiji to discuss the future of the industry, including how best to protect it. So joining us this morning from that meeting in Fiji is Michael Luce, a Vanuatu kava producer and director of South Sea Commodities. With that, I say good morning, Michael.
Good morning. How are you?
Yeah, thank you very much for joining us this morning. You may have heard that discussion just in the previous story. I mean, gosh, how much of a threat is this American company to Pacific growers and the industry?
If I wanted to answer very honestly, they are not a threat at all, but it's a wake-up call. They wanted to make the buzz and they have been very successful in doing it. But it's a wake-up call for all of us in the Pacific. What they are announcing right now with a few hundred plants in Florida, we could have thousands of plants in a couple of years in South America or in Indonesia, and that will be really a treat for farmers. So yeah, it's a wake-up call. We need to see how we can ensure that the kava grown in the Pacific stay ahead of the game, that our farmers are still get a bigger share of the cake and not some farmers in Indonesia or South America.
Of course, there is legislation, Michael, being proposed in Vanuatu to protect its kava. How would that work, though?
Vanuatu's got a legislation since 2002 banning the export of planting material. Kava can only reproduce by cuttings, vegetative manners. You can't, there is no seeds. So you need, if you want to plant some kava somewhere else, you need to put your hand on some planting material. Of course, there is a bit of planting material already available outside the traditional Cava Fenua, like outside the Pacific. But we still need to limit, if we want to limit the propagation of Cava in outside the Pacific, we need to have laws. And not only Vanuatu, all the Cava producing countries needs to have laws stopping the export of planting material. It will not stop, but it will limit and slow down what could become a real threat for the Pacific farmers.
And if we talk about, you know, limit like plantings, in terms of protecting cover, what's actually been discussed there in the meeting that you're attending in Fiji?
Well, there was discussion yesterday about to get more harmonized legislation in the Pacific in regards to cover, because I think not all the countries in the Pacific got some law with standards, qualities, export. So it will be good to have this, because when you've got the legislative framework, you can also improve the quality. And when we improve the quality, we stay ahead of the game, because there will be competition at some stage. So we don't just the latest, the best, put it like this. We're going to talk about GI, geographical indication, in the coming days, but geographical indication will not limit planting outside the Pacific. It will simply restrain people outside the Pacific using some particular names, which needs to be determined. So the effect will be limited on this, but will allow us to keep more or less like a geographical indication, like champagne or whatever.
And with those discussions that you've had there in Fiji, does that instill a bit of hope that that you can protect the quality of cover there in the Pacific?
Oh, sure. Well, we need to always improve the quality of cover. And I think that's why it's highlighted by the different, in the different discussion we had. We are getting in a more global market. Before, the drinkers were just like Pacific Islanders, and now we're trying to share the greatness of cava with more consumers. So we definitely need to abide by all the legislation, GMP and food legislation everywhere, which is quite challenging for small island states. With often limited resources and little support for the private sector, little support for the farmers. So, yeah, we've got many work to do, definitely.
Yeah, do you believe, Michael, that, you know, it all comes back to that quality, right? And if it doesn't fit, if cava from the Pacific is of low quality, that customers will end up going elsewhere, won't they?
At this stage, I think the quality of produce in the Pacific is way ahead of anything else produce outside. we produce great quality, but we just need to improve it and to be more consistent again. But yes.
Well,
cava grown in the Pacific will always be better than any cava grown elsewhere.
And that is probably the discussion that we need to continue to have. And we're glad that you're there in Fiji having those discussions, but we appreciate your time this morning, Michael.
Okay, vinaka.
Vinaka. That, of course, is Michael Luce, a Vanuatu cava producer and director for South Seas Commodities here on Pacific Beat. Stay tuned. Up next is our news wrap.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that honours that tradition, allowing you to hear in-depth personal stories from sportspeople to farmers, artists to teachers, activists to entrepreneurs, with one thing in common: their Pacific heritage and a unique and incredible story to tell. Stories from the Pacific, Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Yes, welcome back to Pacific Beat. It is that time to head around the region, get the latest headlines, and that is brought to us by our producer, Mackenzie Smith. With that, I say good morning, Mackenzie.
Morning, Aggie.
Yeah, let's get into it. Indonesia's military, they've apologised after a video emerged of what appears to be soldiers torturing a Papuan man. Update us.
Yeah, so the viral video emerged sometime last week online, and it shows a defenceless Papuan man being punched, kicked in the face and lacerated with machete as he sits in a barrel of water that turns increasingly red. Obviously very disturbing, and it's prompted widespread condemnation from human rights groups, as well as swift action from the Indonesian government, including from President Joko Widodo's office. Now, the military, the Indonesian military's top figure in Papua, Major General Izak Pangemanan, says 13 military personnel have now been detained and more than 40 questioned as part of an ongoing investigation. Pangemanan says the military condemns what happened and he apologised to all Papuans. Meanwhile, the president of the United Liberation Movement for West Papua, Benny Wenda, he's asking the international community to call out Indonesia at the highest levels of the UN and to continue to push for a visit to West Papua by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights.
Thank you for that. We head to New Zealand, who looks like they're stepping up their help towards the upcoming Solomon Islands elections.
Yeah, New Zealand's government said yesterday it would be sending defence personnel, helicopters and a naval ship as part of a $10.8 million support package for Solomon Islands as it gets ready to go to the polls on April 17th. New Zealand's Foreign Minister Winston Peters says the vessel HMNZS Canterbury will leave Auckland today, bound for Honiara. He says the package also includes funding towards supporting the Solomon Islands Electoral Commission, providing technical support from New Zealand's Electoral Commission for that election, and providing an independent observer mission.
And finally, Vanuatu, though, they're opening a new consulate general in Australia.
They are. It's going to be based in Sydney. Vanuatu's Deputy Prime Minister and Minister of Foreign Affairs, Matai Seremaia, yesterday opened it up in what he says is a landmark event for Vanuatu-Australia relations. He was joined at the opening ceremony by the Governor of New South Wales, Margaret Beasley. And according to a statement from the Vanuatu government, the Consulate General in Sydney will focus on trade and investment links, as well as assisting seasonal workers based in New South Wales. Just over the past 15 months, 20 Vanuatu suppliers have exported more than 57,000 kilograms of kava to the Australian market.
Wow.
So they'll be looking to increase that even more.
Awesome. Mackenzie, thank you so much for bringing our news wrap this morning.
Thanks.
Well, a racial slur from NRL's Sydney Roosters' Spencer Lenu towards Brisbane Broncos player Ezra Mam has landed him an 8-week suspension. Auckland-born Samoan Lenu admitted that he called Torres Strait Islander Mam a monkey during a game, originally stating it was just a loose comment that didn't mean anything. He since has made an apology, but with heated debates online, what has this incident taught us? Well, today we're talking to Andre Afemasanga, a human rights lived experience and social cohesion practitioner in New Zealand and Australia. With that, I say malo le soifua, Andre.
Malo le soifua, morena, and malo elele Agnes. Lovely to be speaking to you this morning.
Absolutely. Andre, thank you so much for obviously taking interest in this story, because I know many people have heard about it. But for those who haven't understood what the situation is, can you probably take us back to what actually happened, even though I did explain it a bit in the beginning there? Do you mind?
Sure. Well, in the NRL's opening game in Las Vegas, which was meant to be a massive deal in terms of selling that game into American market and also to launch the season, the talking point from that Las Vegas game was the fact that Spencer Elu called Ezra Mam a monkey, and the saga that has since ensued from that, which has raised a lot of questions. It's raised questions of racism towards Indigenous Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders in Australia, which is not a new phenomenon, but it happened within an NRL game. And it not only happened in the context of one player to another, but the fact that the player who said that statement was a person of colour or a Samoan person, so someone that also receives racism as well. So while the judiciary has made a ruling and given a punishment to Le Niu, one of the things that I've been so interested in as I've watched this situation unfold is that I feel like an unintended consequence of this saga is the way that racism has been raised, and almost an unintended consequence has been the pitting of Indigenous communities versus Pacific communities on this issue. So I've been watching it with great interest. Some of my background, for those who don't know, is I'm a human rights worker. I used to work at the New Zealand Human Rights Commission in New Zealand, where I was a GM, and my staff looked after things like the Pacific pay gap and Pacific people's rights. But prior to that as well, I was a lead advisor to the former Race Relations Commissioner. And I'm so interested in social cohesion. And for those people that don't know what social cohesion is, it's basically the glue that brings different groups in society together. And sometimes that glue can be strengthened so we can have a really harmonious society. And then sometimes it can be frayed as well. And as I've watched this situation, I've just seen all those different layers and contours occur. And I've seen a fraying of the social cohesion. On one hand, we have absolutely an overdue discussion about racism towards Indigenous communities. That absolutely happens. We need to stay there and hold the gear on that. We need to give that space and time to make sure we don't do that. On the other hand, I kind of feel like communities who also experience racism, such as Pacific and other communities, cultural and linguistic ethnic communities, kind of feel like that their experiences of racism aren't also held on the same level. And there's some good reasons for that, but that's what I've observed in the background.
Andre, and I've had this conversation many times, you know, out of office, where, you know, the NRL has really a big cohort of Māori and Pacific Island players, right? And we understand culturally, often we like to joke amongst ourselves. I'm wondering, though, what is it that we missed here in terms of sports when Le Niu decided to just drop that sort of flippant comment, which really... For ma'am, there is a long history of racism that comes with that comment of calling someone a monkey.
Absolutely. Well, let me unpack a couple of things. First of all, I think for many groups in society that experience racism, it's not uncommon for those of us, for instance, who are brown, black, to have received a racial slur such as the N-word in our lifetime. It's not uncommon for us to have experienced racism, systemic and interpersonal racism. On top of that as well, we do live in a society that is unequal. So we live in a society that is designed for people that are not us. So we experience racism. There's no doubt about that. And sometimes what we've done in many communities that experience racism is that we use the words against us as terms of empowerment. In other words, it's kind of like what you used to harm me, I'm now using to strengthen me. And we've seen that all around the world. But of course, we know that words like the N-word and other words have deep, rich histories upon the people that originally had that experience. So I think there's a couple of things that are happening here. Number one, those of us who experience racism sometimes think that it's then okay for us to pass that racism on to others. And we've done it because people have done it to us, and sometimes it's a unifier. But in this case, what it does and what has shown that the racism that has happened against Indigenous people, Aboriginal, Torres Strait Islanders, is different. And that's sometimes hard for people who experience racism to swallow. And the reason it's different is because this is the land of Indigenous Australians. They are the first Australians. And they've not only just received the interpersonal racism that you and I might receive, but this is on the back of centuries of colonial colonization of racial violence, systemic violence that's happened to them. And these are their lands. They are not diasporas. They cannot go anywhere else. And so I think this is a bit that's missing within our communities when we try to compare our racism to theirs. We just can't. The second thing that's happening here is the NRL is making a really concerted effort to use this as a teaching moment for everyone. So the judiciary said that in its comments about Le Niu. They said that they want to make a strong example of the situation to prevent this type of racism. which I get. And, you know, sport is a really important setting. We love sport and we love sport, but it's also almost the microcosm of what's happening in wider society as well. So in other words, when this type of issue raises up, it means that it reveals a discussion point that many of us are actually thinking about. So in this case, NRL know the influence that they have, and so they want to make this a teaching moment for everyone. The issue that I have, though, is that the person that's receiving the teaching moment is someone like Spencer Lunu, who is Samoan, and as if he doesn't know what it is like to receive racism. Yes, definitely our communities need to get better. We need to know our place and respect to our Indigenous brothers and sisters, the First Nations people of the land. But to assume that he needs racism education, that's a bit of a joke to me. And as I was watching the commentary in Australia, it happened to be in Australia the week that he received the judiciary finding, and I was so interested. On mainstream TV, you had hosts who don't receive racism, and they were saying how much Spencer needs this racism education. I was listening to conservative talkback radio in Australia, and people in settings that would normally deny the existence of racism and try to downplay it, we're actually saying that Lunil belonged in another century and education from his overdue. And absolutely, we do not want to decenter Ezra Mam or the experience of racism and violence that has happened against Indigenous peoples. But Spencer Lunil is not new to racism. He's been a student of racism since the day he was born. Every place he was born, whether it's Auckland or Australia, he has been on the receiving end of racism, and that's what's missing from this. It's missing that sort of nuance. And there's almost been, in my view, a bit of a punching down on not only Spencer Lunu, but Pacific communities. And I think this is why we see in some of our communities this bit of this light pushback. And I think for them, it's not sitting well, because while he has been made an example of, I think to many of us, we're like, but we also receive racism. So it's kind of, I think that's sort of left in the air, and it's an unintended consequence. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't focus on eliminating racism against Indigenous people. But to then suggest that Pacific people don't receive it at all is kind of missing another point. So I've been frustrated by that.
Yeah, I want to get to the point of Lunu's apology. I know some have said that it's come off self-centred, but even Mam himself has refused to even have a bit of a face-to-face meeting. I'm wondering, culturally, the context, could that have been done a little bit better? To restore that relationship, have a bit more of a cultural approach?
Yeah, absolutely. That's absolutely what I believe, Agnes. And I think what happens in this situation is that, in the NRL, everyone knows that if you, violate the code, then an early guilty plea or an apology or a recognition or an acknowledgement of your what you've done will help you when you go before the judiciary. And so I think that's what people have categorized Lunu's apology as. I think they've said, okay, what he wants to do is just, go up there and say sorry to him face to face. So if you know anything, and this is why I really call for the NRL to have culturally intelligent and culturally safe advice, because if you know anything about Samoans, we have this concept VA, which is also a Pan-Pacific concept as well, which is the concept of relationships. VA means both space and it means relationships. And we are continuously always nurturing the space between us and someone else. So between us, or in all of our personal interactions and other interactions, the VA exists. But when there is a violation or a breach of that relationship VA, it's contingent on the offender to actually make it up and promptly do it. So it's to acknowledge their wrong and to actually make sure they say sorry to the person who they've offended. And inaction or delayed action will bring shame not only upon the person, upon their families. And so I think when people were initially seeing Lunu's sorry, I think they were categorizing it as a normal sorry, the kind of the sorry that you're meant to say when you're in a situation like this, almost like a PR stunt almost. But I think that misses the point and misses the richness of a Samoan sorry. And for us, like once we know we are sorry, we are like want to make amends. And it's not just for us, it's for the person. So I think number one, I think we've misunderstood the sorry perhaps that Lunu wanted to issue in that moment. It comes from a different place for us. It really comes from our heart. The second thing is that the judiciary process is meant to bring fairness. So they want to be as objective as possible and make sure that everyone gets the same sort of punishment. But what's happened in this situation is that while Lunu has got this punishment for 8 weeks, and why Ezra Mam's experience of racism needs to be respected, there's no doubt about that, and why he can refuse an apology, there's no doubt about that, In my view, what we have is we've got a decision ruling, but what we don't have is we don't have healing. In other words, we've got two communities who are sort of just sort of moving forward, but not necessarily together. And I knew that many people were frustrated, for instance, by Jonathan Thurston speaking out and Latrell speaking out. So, you know, in backing Ezra Madam, and that's a really great thing, which is awesome. But I think what some Pacific communities was feeling like their experience was misset out on that.
Yeah.
And so I believe that the judiciary needs to augment it with a restorative justice process. And that means a process that can augment the judiciary in ways that restores relationships. So that when we leave, we don't just get a ruling, we also get restored relationships and better quality conversations in our communities that don't not deny people's existence of racism.
Oh, Andre, I would love to carry this conversation on. It is such an important one, but we have to wrap up for today. But I do appreciate you giving a little bit of insight into this Talanoa. So we thank you for your time. Faftai Lava.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Agnes.
No worries. That, of course, is Andre Afamasanga, human rights, lived experience and social cohesion practitioner in New Zealand and Australia here on Pacific Beat. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Main story this morning, Governor of PNG, Esipik Alan Bird, says there's an urgent need for water filters following a magnitude 6.9 earthquake on Sunday.
I'm going to be meeting with the US government this week and those filters, and hopefully we can get some help in by way of, say, maybe a military aircraft flying them across to us from the US.
Well, we'll do the same thing, same time, same place tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. News is next. After that, it's Nisha Daily. But until tomorrow, have an amazing day. O toa o whātou. I am Aggie Dubow, and you've been tuning into Pacific Beat.